Appalachia, the word that evokes a whole passel of reactions. Everything from the beauty of a mountaintop to trailer parks, drugs, and about everything in between. The Appalachian Mountains are indeed the oldest mountains in the world. They once towered 30,000 feet into the air. They stretch from eastern Canada through 14 states all the way to Louisiana. The folks who live in these mountains have faced an unending number of tragic and just plain odd happenings that cry out for the telling. Hello, I'm Larry Bentley, and I was born and raised in these very mountains by a family who themselves were born, raised, and lived for generations in the heart of the Appalachian Mountains. Come with me and we'll take a look at some of the unending stories that come from within my beloved mountains. And we'll look through the eyes of an old Appalachian at some outside the area as well. Welcome to Season 4 of Appalachian Murder, Mystery, and Legend.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Howdy, my good friends. I hope all's well with you and yours. Thank you for stopping by today. And thank you, Susan Bowman, for your kind review on Apple Podcasts. You're absolutely right. I do know where Cambria is. My mother was born and raised in a little place called Vickers Switch there in Montgomery County, and she attended Cambria Elementary School as a child. It's a beautiful place and part of my old stomping grounds. Thank you so much for listening and reviewing the podcast. That really helps things grow and move along. And one more thing while I'm on it. I will be starting the videos back up on YouTube as soon as I come up with just a little bit better way of doing them. Nobody needs to suffer what I've put up there so far. But thank you so much for trying them anyway, folks. Now, I don't know how many of you out there have suffered the loss of a loved one, maybe a friend or a family member. I sure have, and I can tell you that it's something that you never get over. It's like your life is one nice big puzzle with all the pieces fit together perfectly. Then when something like that happens, it's like a piece of their piece of a puzzle has been ripped off and thrown away, leaving nothing but emptiness where it once was. Now, it's so stunning that it don't even sink in for a while, and even though they're gone, your life will never be the same again. And trust me when I say God bless good-hearted folks for trying, but there's nothing anybody can say to help as hard as they might try. It's just the most empty feeling in the world. You also realize just how many others are going through it with you because the lost loved one meant the world to them too. When one person is lost, there's so many whose lives will never be the same. Now imagine if two people were lost in the same family at the same time. I don't know how in the world family would deal with that kind of loss, but I can tell you that it happened in a part of the Appalachian Mountains, and the families and friends of those lost are still dealing with the fallout from the whole thing. So have a seat, take your shoes off, set a spell, and let me tell you about what happened in the Tennessee Mountains back in 1992. Now, on the evening of February 21st, 1992, a man named James Dillinger and his nephew Gary Sutton were doing what they normally did on Friday evening in Sevier County, Tennessee. They hit the bar scene. They were drinking and playing pool with Mr. Dillinger's neighbor, Tommy Griffin. The bartender said that the three men left around 7 p.m. that evening and that she didn't notice anything odd or out of place. Reason that she was asked those questions to start with? Well, we'll have to get into that. Just after our trio left the bar, a couple was driving down the road nearby when they noticed a car pulled off the side of the road. They saw two men outside of the car, apparently trying to drag another man out of the back seat. Folks might wonder, why not stop and try to help? But here in the mountains, that was a pretty normal thing to run across back then. Boys would go out and have a drink, get all red, fight, and then go back home, laugh it off, and to top it all off, be right back at it on Saturday night. While folks didn't stop and help, apparently they did think that it was a little more than a run-of-the-mill Friday night in Sevier County because they ended up calling the law. Now, while officers were en route to that location, another person saw a man walking down the same road without a shirt on. Now, with it being wintertime and all, that report was the next to blare out over the police radios because the person that saw that man was concerned enough about him freezing to death that they called and reported it to police. Now, on the way to check out the report, an officer conducted a traffic stop. Apparently, things get a little bit lively on the weekends in the Appalachian Mountains, and you might notice. Now, notice I say that like I wouldn't know, right? So, while that officer was tied up on that, he called another officer in and to check out a man that was about to freeze to death report. Now, when the second officer arrived, he found a pickup truck on the side of the road with two men in it. The man in the back of the truck was Tommy Griffin. Mr. Griffin didn't have a shirt on and was just shy of monkey on the intoxication meter. Now, he told the officers that his friends had kicked him out of their car, but he wouldn't say who the friends were or why they had left him in the side of the road to freeze to death, but that it was better probably to take him back to a warm jail for his own good, and there was probable cause that he was a little less than sober, and the officer arrested Mr. Griffin for public intoxication around 7:40 that evening. Yes, folks, all of that happened in about 40 minutes. But we ain't done yet. About an hour after Tommy was booked into the jail, James Dellinger showed up at the police department trying to bail him out, but was told that due to the charge, there was a minimum waiting period of 4 hours. Got to give the man time to undrunk himself, so hopefully there won't be no more trouble. Nip it in the bud, like old Barney Fife used to say. Now, so Mr. Dellinger went on back home. As we already said, he and Tommy were neighbors, so they lived on a road with several mobile homes on it. Not exactly a trailer park, but a place where everybody living there decided to drag him up a mobile home instead of trying to build that far out in the mountains. Mr. Dellinger lived in one of them with his wife. Tommy Griffin lived in another one, and still yet another, Tommy's sister Connie Branham lived in one. Now, a neighbor reported that around 9 o'clock that night, they saw Mr. Dellinger's truck stopped on the side of the road near Tommy's house and saw somebody run away from the house and get into the passenger seat before the truck sped off. Apparently, Mr. Dellinger hadn't done enough yet because just about the time the truck pulled out into the Dellinger driveway, which was a couple of houses down, the neighbors saw flames coming out of Tommy Griffin's house. That's when they called the police, who hadn't already done enough, apparently. I guess they probably could qualify for a marathon with all the running they've done already. Of course, the proper authorities were dispatched to take care of the fire, and an investigation followed. What with it, all of the evidence at the scene, along with the witness statement, it would be determined that it was an arson. I reckon if they couldn't get him out of jail, then they'd just go and do the next best thing and burn his house down. And I just wonder what Tommy said to make him mad enough to throw him out in the cold, half-naked, and then still be worked up enough to go torch his house. Sounds to me like old boy either had a lip on him or he knew something he wasn't supposed to know. Anyway, Connie, and you remember her, she's Tommy's sister, had a daughter named Jennifer. About the time the fire started, Jennifer ran over to the Dellinger house to see if they knew where her Uncle Tommy was. They told her that he had met up with a girl at the tavern and had left with her. Now, Uncle Tommy was indeed a bit of a ladies' man, but something about the way Mr. Dellinger said that just didn't strike Jennifer as being on the up and up. In fact, after that, she didn't trust the man any further than she could throw him. So she kept her eyes peeled on the Dellinger place from her house. That's when she saw Mr. Dellinger slide out the door, take what appeared to be a shotgun from the back of his truck and stuff it in his wife's car. Then she saw Mr. Dellinger and his nephew Gary Sutton leave. All of this, you know, what was going on while Tommy's house was still in the midst of going up in smoke. Now, records show that around 11:25 that night, Mr. Dellinger went to the county jail and bailed out Tommy Griffin. There were a plethora of people, including police officers, who saw him leaving the police station together. The next morning, Jennifer was up early because I reckoned that she was worried about her Uncle Tommy, since his house had burned up and all, and wanted to see him when he showed up from his mystery girl's house. She was watching out the window when she saw Mr. Dellinger take the same shotgun from his wife's car that he'd placed in it the night before. So he walked it back and stuffed it under his mobile home. As noon started to get closer, Connie decided that she needed to go look for her brother, who had never made it back home. Even though his home was now a smoldering hole in the ground, you'd think he'd still want to come back to it to find out that that happened. But around 2 o'clock, she was seen at a local grocery store asking if anybody had seen her brother. At this point, nobody in Tommy's family knew anything about him being arrested for anything. After nobody in the store had seen Tommy, Connie walked outside where the owner of the store noticed her in the parking lot talking to two men in a white pickup truck. The two men were James Dellinger and Gary Sutton. By all accounts, it seems Connie wasn't about to let anything go and just go back home nor shut up about where her brother was. Somebody was going to produce Tommy or tell her what she needed to go to produce him herself. I reckon that they must have told Connie that they'd seen her brother the night before at a local bar because the three of them headed over there. I bet they left out the part where they threw him out into the cold half-naked. He got arrested and they bailed him out. But that part must have just never come up in the conversation, folks. Note here. Yeah, you know, folks, the best thing you can do when somebody's missing is to check with law enforcement first, because people that are up to no good don't care what happens to anybody. Stick around, folks. I'll be right back. You're listening to Appalachian Murder, Mystery, and Legend with Larry Bentley. Now, the bartender on duty when they got there had seen all three men the night before. Her shift had ended before they left. At 5 o'clock, the next bartender came in and confirmed that Connie, Tommy had certainly been there with Mr. Sutton and Mr. Dellinger shooting pool that evening, you know, before the evening before this. Now, Mr. Dellinger tried to get the bartender to say that he and Mr. Sutton had left Tommy with a woman, but the bartender specifically seen the three leave together and wasn't shy about saying so. Apparently, seeing that wasn't going to work. Mr. Dellinger said that they'd returned after they'd bailed Tommy out. Now, the bartender knew that wasn't true either. Mr. Dellinger then asked the barkeep whether she was married, and learning that she was, he then made a statement about how it'd be a shame if she'd come up missing one day. Apparently, he was starting up a business of making people disappear, and I don't mean David Copperfield style. Now, Connie, Mr. Dellinger, and Mr. Sutton left the bar around 6:30, so Connie had been there asking about her brother for about an hour and a half, making it clear that she wasn't about to let it go when it came to her brother. So, along about 8 o'clock at night, a couple saw a fire in the woods near their house. Apparently, it was not enough to warrant a call to the fire department. After all, it was still cold outside, and folks used campfires to stay warm. Yes, they're tenacious people enough to go out and winter camp. I used to be one of them. You'll never experience anything more beautiful than camping while it's snowing, but you dang sure better be prepared for it or it ain't going to end well. Now, the next morning of the aforementioned couple that we just heard from, saw two men in a white truck pull out of the woods near the area where she had seen the fire the night before. I reckon with it being a Sunday and all, they decided to call it a weekend and head home. Now, on Monday, February 24th, which was the next day, a man had gone to a local fishing pond with his daughters to do a little fishing. That's where the man, along with his young daughters, discovered a body and called the police. Turned out to be the body of Tommy Griffin. He had been shot in the back of the head near the base of his neck with a 12-gauge shotgun. Folks, the injury that a 12-gauge shotgun does can't even be described unless you've seen it, let alone the fact that Tommy had been shot twice with one. They knew that because there was two spent 12-gauge shotgun shells found near Tommy, as well as some beer cans. It would be determined that the shells match the wounds, and they also match shells found in James Dellinger's yard. A man who owned a house close to the swimming hole, or fishing hole, whichever one you want to call it, reported that he had heard two or maybe three shots right around midnight late on the 21st. Yes, that would be just after Tommy was bailed out of jail. But folks, that wasn't all. Friday, February 28th rolled around, and Connie Branham's body was found in her burned-out car where the couple had seen the fire the night of February 22nd. Because of the condition of her body, the coroner couldn't determine the time of death, but they did know that she had been killed, not by the fire, but by a rifle. They found a .303 shell at the scene. Now, folks, that's another devastating weapon that would be linked to a gun found in the Dellinger property. So, as you can guess, after an investigation, which was just a matter of tracing breadcrumbs left by the two criminal geniuses, James Dellinger and Gary Sutton, were pounced on, arrested, and dragged off to the Blount County Jail for processing. Now, there was one complication to the whole mess, and that was the fact that Tommy Griffin had been murdered in Blount County and Connie in Sevier County. Now, that meant that Sevier County was going to want their pound of flesh for the wrongdoings in their county as soon as possible. Blount County agreed to oblige the people of Sevier County by turning the two defendants over to be tried there first because they felt like they had a better case against them for Connie's murder than they had for Tommy's murder. Now, the two defendants would be tried together and tried twice. Now, first in Sevier County, they were convicted of first-degree premeditated murder and given life sentences. Then, dragged over to Blount County, were then subjected to the rigorous battery of another trial. In September of 1996, they were convicted in Blount County, too, for the murder of Tommy Griffin. Now, the jury had been made aware of the conviction in Sevier County and had no love to give for the scoundrels and recommended the death penalty for both defendants. But as we all know, in all death penalty cases, appeals drag on and on for years on end. Neither of the cases were successful in overturning their convictions or sentences, but they did bring up some pretty interesting points, especially in the case of James Dellinger. Now, in his case, the biggest argument was his intelligence level. The Supreme Court has ruled that anybody with an IQ below 70 can't be executed due to their mental capacity. Now, after reading up on the details of this case, I can certainly agree with that he ain't the brightest bulb in the box, but with an IQ of 70, he'd be more likely to be the empty box than a bulb to start with. Just as the case in just about every other case, you can go out and find yourself an expert to agree with or your assessment, I reckon, if the price is right. In this case, the defendant had people saying Mr. Dellinger's IQ was in the 68-69 range, while the state said it was more like 72-83 range. In comparison, Mr. Sutton's IQ had been found to be in the level of 77-83 range, meaning that they both have lower intelligence level. Now, somewhere in the range of a milk jug, I'd say. Now, in Mr. Dellinger's case, it was said that he left school at the age of 10 and didn't have the ability to read or write, while Mr. Sutton dropped out in the 8th grade. Now, in 2015 report, yes, it's still going on in 2015, a judge ruled that the attorney who had handled Mr. Dellinger's appeal case, Catherine Brockenbrower, was as well as her boss, Donald Dawson, had been inadequate. They had been provided by the state under the public defender rule. The judge stated that they were both grossly negligent. Of course, Mrs. Brockenborough would be fired in 2007 for reasons undetermined that I could find, but she did suffer from bipolar disorder, and at the time she was handling Mr. Dellinger's case, she was in the midst of a mental breakdown and missed filings and in several areas. Now, the judge chastised Mr. Dawson, who retired in 2012, because in his words, he was overwhelmed with cases, but in the words of the judge, yeah, just too busy to care, huh? But whoever heard the appeal later that year upheld his conviction and sentence. That left him sitting in his cell, staring out the window, wondering who hit John. Gary Sutton's appeals were about as confusing as it gets. He tried arguing that the witness for the state had falsified or misrepresented their credentials. In doing so, they were also arguing the time of death set for Tommy Griffin, as this expert, not being a credentialed expert, wouldn't know time of death from time for lunch. Now, as I said earlier, the appeals failed and the conviction and sentences were upheld for Mr. Sutton, too. One thing that I never did find out, and that was the reason why they killed Tommy Griffin in the first place. They figured that his sister was murdered to stop her from raising so much of a stink about her missing brother. Most folks around about the area believe that the reason the two men were given the death sentence in Tommy's case was because the jury had been made aware of their conviction in Connie's case. Now, I would probably tend to agree with that, but that much of it. But what I think might be odd is the death penalty wasn't served up to him for Connie's case to start with, considering what they did it for. I seriously doubt that Gary Sutton will ever get his IV appointment with the Tennessee Board of Corrections. Heck, he has supporters who think he's innocent, and he still expects to be released any time now. James Dellinger? Well, he dang sure won't. He dropped over in the middle of death row from the three-drug cocktail of free cable TV, free food, and free internet access back in January of 2023. What with him having such a low IQ and all, I just wonder if somebody had to break the news to him that he was dead, or maybe he was aware of it to start with. Tennessee has nearly 100 people on death row and hadn't offed any of them since 2009. Anybody convicted before 1998 has the warden bring in a menu with two options on it. I reckon for the ones with low IQs, it has pictures. The condemned prisoner checks off the box with his and her choice, either electric chair or lethal injection. In the event that a timely choice isn't made, I guess the state of Tennessee will gladly do it for him. Folks, I hope you got something out of our story today. I sure can't imagine what the family and friends of Tommy and Connie have been and are going through. God bless every one of them. Please throw us a rate and review of whatever you're listening on, and don't forget to follow us and subscribe so you'll know when another episode drops. Come on over to Facebook group, Appalachian Murder, Mystery, and Legend Podcast, where we talk Appalachian or about anything else you want to talk about. I'll be back real soon with another Appalachian Murder, Mystery, or Legend, and I will see you then.